Hi class, this is your professor again, Dr. Fields, returning for part two of our lecture on neurodevelopmental disorders. So we left off finishing up with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, which can definitely have an impact on one's academic functioning. Definitely, at the very least, indirectly. And now we're going to talk about neurodevelopmental disorders that would have more of a direct impact on learning. Okay? And we're going to use that word very broadly, learning in terms of learning all sorts of things, learning academic information all the way to learning self-help skills, independent skills to help one function more independently, and also learning social skills, etc., etc., etc. Okay? All right. So that brings us to slide 13. Okay. And what we're going to talk about now are learning disorders and language disorders, which, I mean, really all of these disorders that we're going to be talking about now could be considered a learning type of disorder. So let me make the distinction between specific learning disorder, that's what we're going to be talking about, and these other kinds of disorders. I'm going to group specific learning disorder and language disorder together for this next discussion. Okay? All right. So on slide 13, you should see specific learning and language disorders, right? Okay. Causes. We'll talk about that first, as we always do. There seems to be a strong genetic influence in both types of these disorders. All these neurodevelopmental disorders have a very strong genetic influence or biological underpinnings, much more so than the large majority of disorders we've talked about up until this point. In addition, for learning disorders, or I should say specific learning disorders, there is evidence of faulty or abnormal functioning in some specific areas of the left hemisphere of the brain. And this really depends on the specific learning disorder in terms of what particular area in the left hemisphere is functioning abnormally or seems different from, quote, normal people. You might recall that the brain is divided into two hemispheres, the left and the right. The left hemisphere has been associated in general with linguistic or language functioning, and the right hemisphere has been associated with nonverbal learning or information. So it makes sense, right? Especially if we're looking at reading and writing, that the left hemisphere would be involved because it has to do with language, okay? And mathematics, of course, also has to do with language in the sense that when you're learning math, you're being instructed in a certain language, right? If you're here in the United States, you're being instructed in the English language, so that would also make sense. So even for math, it seems like the left hemisphere is implicated at least to some degree. Okay. Chronic ear infections during early childhood have also been implicated in language disorder, specifically for reading disorder, and especially language disorder. We know that young children who have had chronic ear infections often will have delays in their reading skills or language development. And the reason is because the ear is very important in any kind of language-based task. In terms of obviously, when we're hearing the spoken word and processing it and learning to process it correctly, and learning to comprehend language and understand language and understand the relationship between different sounds, and their meaning, what they're trying to convey. We know what somebody is talking about when they use the word learning, right? We understand what that word means. Those sounds together convey a certain message to us, and we understand what that message is and what that means. When we're reading, although many of us do not read aloud, it's been shown in the research that that phonological loop is still involved, that the ear, the inner ear, is still involved in processing language, so that when you're reading, you're literally talking to yourself, and the ear is, involved in processing that information in terms of the sounds and being able to put those sounds together to form meaning, etc., etc. Okay? So that could also be a reason why children may be delayed in their reading development or their language development. Okay? Okay. Moving right along to slide 14. What kinds of interventions exist for learning and language disorders? Well, medical treatment or psychotropic medication has not been found to be useful or helpful in alleviating the nature of learning or language disorders or alleviating their symptoms. They, of course, could be useful for addressing associated symptoms and comorbid disorders. A lot of children that have learning and language-based disorders may suffer from low self-esteem or even some depression or anxiety. Or even as adults with these kinds of disorders. And certainly medication treatment could help for those associated symptoms, but they're not going to do anything to remediate the deficits inherent in these two disorders, okay? And psychological interventions are the same. Again, they're really only useful for addressing associated symptoms and comorbid disorders. Cognitive behavioral therapy, psychodynamic therapy is not really going to do much for somebody with a specific learning or language disorder. All right. Okay, not directly anyway. That's what we're saying here. Okay, moving on to slide 15, let's talk about two more disorders that have even more of a global impact on one's learning. There is intellectual disability that we talked about. It used to be called mental retardation, and autism spectrum disorder, which used to be called pervasive developmental disability, and then there were subtypes included within that category. Autism was one, Asperger's was another one, pervasive developmental disability not otherwise specified was another one, and now we just refer to the category as autism spectrum disorder. That these disorders all have autistic types of symptoms and features and occur on a continuum from mild to severe. And even intellectual disabilities occur on a continuum from mild to severe. But understand that when we're saying one has an intellectual disability, it is a severe disorder. So within that category, there are finer distinctions between how severe it is that we use those kind of specifiers of mild, moderate, and severe. Okay? But, these are both severe disorders, okay, by their very nature. Okay, intellectual disability. Again, there seems to be a strong genetic influence, especially with regards to chromosomal disorders for intellectual disability, right? Also, exposure to toxins or disease in utero, labor complications, infections, and head injury have all been shown to be related to the development of this disorder. In addition, severe abuse, neglect, and deprivation during infancy and early childhood can also play a role in the development of this disorder. For autism spectrum disorder, again, there is a strong genetic influence, and in addition, there have been abnormalities found in the amygdala, which we know is involved in emotional processing, and abnormalities in the level of one's oxytocin, which is a neurochemical, interestingly enough, related to social bonding. So they have also been found to correlate with this disorder. Correlate, right? We're not saying that they cause it necessarily, but they're found to be associated with it. So that's very interesting, right? Because we know that children with autism have difficulties bonding socially, right? Or bonding to other people. And that can be heartbreaking to a parent, when your child does not accept your affection or does not give affection back to you. That can be very heartbreaking. And then also that they have difficulties with emotional processing. We know that children with autism have difficulties expressing their feelings or expressing, their true feelings or regulating their feelings or understanding feelings in others, not being able to identify when somebody else is sad or angry or, of some other kind of feeling. Okay? Okay. Moving on to slide number 16. What kinds of medical treatments have been found to be effective for intellectual disability and autism spectrum disorder? Well, SSRIs, which we know are a type of classification of medications that target depression and also anxiety as well, and some other kinds of psychological symptoms. They are known as the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors that affect that neurotransmitter, right? And tranquilizers, which could include more mild ones like the benzodiazepines that we talked about that target anxiety, they have been found to be effective for reducing the irritability and frustration in people with autism spectrum disorder, which are associated kinds of symptoms, right? And other, with that being said, they are, effective for targeting those other symptoms, but not effective for really reducing the severity of the autism spectrum disorder itself, right? So medication has really only been found effective for reducing these kinds of associated symptoms. Otherwise, psychotropic medication is again, just like for specific learning disorder and language disorder, is only useful really for other associated symptoms and comorbid disorders such as depression, anxiety, etc., etc. Okay? Psychological interventions, cognitive behavioral therapy. Now, here, cognitive behavioral therapy can be helpful in terms of teaching social skills for both children with intellectual disability and autism spectrum disorder, emotional identification skills, again, for both children. Children with intellectual disability are going to be delayed intellectually, and so it's going to be difficult for them to learn all sorts of things, right? So, aside from academic learning, they also need assistance with learning social emotional skills, okay? And autism, because it's the very nature of the disorder, that it really has an impact on social emotional functioning. And also teaching these children coping skills, especially children with autism that have a great difficulty with self-regulation or regulating emotions, right? Behavior management plans can be important with contingencies in terms of teaching both of these types of children appropriate behaviors, and applied behavioral analysis very often is used with children with autism because they can be so resistant to learning certain kinds of skills that we have to really break down these skills into very discrete units, and then reinforce each approximation that they make behaviorally towards the overall objective or goal, which is, learning to regularly do that kind of skill. So applied behavioral analysis is very important, especially with children with autism. And remember, about a third of all autistic children, or children on the autism spectrum disorder, have intellectually deficient IQs, which really, compounds the situation. Parent training, again, for children with both intellectual disability and autism spectrum disorder, parents need to be trained very specifically on how to deal with the nature of these disorders in their children. And then relaxation training, especially for kids with autism spectrum disorder, that can get very frustrated easily and agitated easily because they have a very rigid kind of thinking style, are very perseverative and set in their ways. And when things don't go according to their plans or expectations, they can really act out behaviorally or, emotionally. And so we need to teach them, certain kinds of relaxation techniques, such as certain breathing techniques, to really be able to calm down emotionally and help them regulate emotionally more effectively. All right, moving on to slide number 17. So, after I talk about the causes for these different kinds of disorders and, whether or not there is a role that medication or psychological interventions can play, I really wanted to talk about the most effective interventions in general for all four of these disorders. And those kinds of interventions are school-based or academic interventions, right? If we're saying that these children have a great difficulty with learning to varying degrees, then it makes sense that the crux of our interventions are going to be academic-based, okay? The most important interventions for the majority of these neurodevelopmental disorders are those that aim to improve these children's academic skills, problem-solving ability, language development, independent, adaptive, or self-care behavior, and social skills. And all of these skills can be taught in the school environment. Okay? We have children that are very delayed in the high school that I work at, and are in a very specialized program where, not only are academic skills emphasized, but maybe even more importantly, are independent living skills. They're taught how to do laundry, how to cook. They are, for a large part of their school day, taught different kinds of vocational or occupational skills, where they'll go and work a few hours at, let's say, Panera Bread, or Chipotle, and learn how to, do those different kinds of skills, whether it be involved in, preparing food or cleaning or, some other kind of task inherent in these businesses. So a lot of these different kinds of skills that they need to learn, can be done in the school setting. And are done in the school setting. So these kinds of learning, this specialized kind of learning is most effectively carried out in the educational setting by various school professionals. So who are the people that work with these children with these learning kinds of disorders? Special education teachers, reading specialists, school psychologists such as myself, school social workers, speech pathologists, occupational therapy or OT, physical therapy, or I'm sorry, an occupational therapist or a physical therapist, a PT, etc. Also, associated difficulties such as acting out, off task, or withdrawn behavior can be effectively targeted in this setting as well, right? That we can develop and implement behavioral management plans to really work on their behavior, and also school-based counseling, where we can instruct the child on a one-to-one setting or in a group of his or her peers on, appropriate behavior. And especially appropriate social behavior if we're working with them in a group. ADHD children, for example, who often have academic weaknesses and social problems, along with behavioral difficulties resulting from their disorder, can benefit a lot from school-based interventions as well, and services, which can include academic remedial services, their off-task inattentive behavior can have an adverse impact on their academic development, and so a lot of them will require some kind of remediation. Behavioral management plans to target their off-task or inattentive behavior to help them stay on track, so to speak. Counseling to work on more appropriate social behavior, or to help them self-monitor their behavior, like we talked about, and certainly to work through any negative feelings that may result from their disorder in terms of feeling badly about their academic achievement or social problems, etc., etc. So really, school-based academic interventions, not only for learning disorder, language disorder, intellectual disability, and autism spectrum disorder, but also can be very important for children with ADHD as well. Now, not all kids with ADHD need school-based interventions. Some are very effectively treated with medication and need very little extra assistance in the school if their condition is more mild. And again, that's a relative term, right? Mild relative to having ADHD. And then others, their ADHD is so severe, even with medication, that they still need extra help in the school. But when you're talking about children with specific learning disorder, language disorder, and especially intellectual disability and autism spectrum disorder, they are definitely going to need some school-based support by the very nature of their disorder. Okay. On to slide 18, school-based or academic interventions. Continuing with this discussion. While students need not be classified under the Section 504, which is of the Rehabilitation Act, or IDEA, which is special education laws, being classified makes many more services at school available to them. Okay? So, again, if you're talking about specific learning disorder, autism spectrum disorder, those children are almost always going to need some kind of specialized assistance, which is going to be granted under Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act or IDEA, the special education laws. But children with ADHD may or may not need those kinds of services, depending on the severity of the impact of their disorder. So, before I talk more about Section 504 and IDEA, I want to first discuss the distinction between being diagnosed and being classified. Now, on some level, on a general level, they're almost synonymous in the in the sense that both result in some kind of label. And I know label has gotten like a very negative sorry, a very negative stigma. But I believe if the label is not just a means to an end, but it actually leads to something positive, like a person getting a proper kind of treatment or a person getting the help or assistance they need at school, then it's not a bad thing. Labeling someone for the sake of labeling someone is not good, but coming up with a label so that that entitles them to some kind of support or helps the professional understand the nature of their difficulties so that that can drive appropriate intervention and treatment can be a very good thing, okay? But anyway, with that digression, what is the difference between being diagnosed and classified? Well, a diagnosis results from meeting the DSM-5 criteria for a disorder as per a professional, a psychiatrist, a psychologist, etc. So, in other words, all of these disorders that we've been discussing, the criteria for all of these disorders, are all found in the DSM-5. Okay? And so, when a person meets these criteria, according to a professional, right? So, in other words, like you all are not licensed professionals, so you can't technically diagnose somebody, even though you may be pretty accurate. You might be able to say, hey, Aunt Joni really seems to have, bipolar disorder, and you might be correct. You can't legally diagnose anyone because you're not licensed yet. So, assuming that one is licensed, if the person that they're seeing meets DSM-5 criteria for a certain disorder, then that results in what we call a diagnosis. And we discussed that way early on in the beginning of our course. Being classified means you meet criteria for a disability under Section 504 or IDEA. Okay, so under those sets of laws, if you meet criteria for access to services under those or accommodations under those laws, that's what we're essentially talking about with being classified. Okay, so think of diagnosis as pertaining to the DSM-5, and think of classification as pertaining to meeting criteria under Section 504 or IDEA. Now, Section 504, quote, classification, because a lot of times, people don't necessarily use that term classification. They just say, oh, they meet criteria under Section 504. But to kind of keep things on a similar playing field here, we're going to say that being classified under Section 504 ultimately means that one has a disability as per that set of laws, and therefore is entitled to some kind of support. Okay? Section 504 pertains to both occupational and educational settings. So it's not, it doesn't just, that law doesn't just pertain to children, but it also pertains to adults. So if you're an adult with ADHD and you meet classification or criteria requirements under Section 504, you could get certain accommodations at your place of work. IDEA, which is known as special education law, and IDEA stands for Individuals with Disabilities Educational Act. That only pertains to children in compulsory education, which is from kindergarten to 12th grade, and includes 13 different classifications. Okay? So under 504, if you have a disability, however that might be defined, then you meet classification requirements. And for IDEA, you have to meet criteria for one of either 13 different classifications, which we'll talk about soon. While you do not need a diagnosis to get classified, in certain cases you do, or it's strongly recommended, or it may be required as per a school's policy. So, for example, a school district may say, hey, if you want to get assistance through Section 504 and justify that you have a disability, we're going to need to see documentation of a diagnosis from either a licensed psychologist or a psychiatrist. Okay? But you don't necessarily need to be diagnosed in all cases. Okay, special note here. Most neurodevelopmental disorders will meet IDEA classification criteria. The way to really look at the distinction between Section 504 and IDEA is when a child meets criteria under IDEA, we're saying that the nature of their disability has a more severe, significant impact on their learning. And for Section 504, we're saying it has an impact. It could be a less direct impact, but it's having some impact on their educational functioning or their learning, but not to the same degree as IDEA. So, under IDEA or special education law, we're saying that student, by the nature of his disability being more severe, needs more intensive direct services in school, and under Section 504, less direct and not such intensive kinds of services. Okay? Okay. So, learning disorder will, the majority of the time, meet criteria under IDEA. Language disorder, the majority of the time, will meet criteria under IDEA. And then intellectual disability and autism spectrum disorder, again, the large majority of the time. In fact, intellectual disability almost always will meet criteria under IDEA. I can't see a situation where it won't because the nature of the disorder is so extreme. Autism spectrum disorder many times will meet criteria under IDEA, but not always because some children have what's called high functioning autism, and they don't need such direct services because it, their disorder doesn't have such a severe impact on their academic functioning. It certainly will have an impact on their social functioning, which also will meet requirements for getting assistance at school, but maybe more under like a Section 504 plan, okay? And then ADHD, it depends. If it's severe enough, it definitely can meet criteria under IDEA. If it's not as severe, it could meet criteria under Section 504, okay? So these are two different sets of laws. Okay. Emotional disorders, for example, anxiety, depression, they could meet criteria under either Section 504 or IDEA, depending on the severity of the disorder and the degree of impact that it has on the child's functioning. If the child's anxiety disorder is so pronounced that it really impacts, their learning, they could definitely require support under IDEA for special education services. Okay. All right. Classifying under either Section 504 or IDEA, people with addictive disorders or disruptive behavior disorders remains very controversial. We talked about that a little bit when we were discussing the disruptive behavior disorders. In a prior lecture of ours, sometimes there's a lot of controversy as to whether or not these children should get specialized kinds of help, because, people will kind of look at this as, well, this is, a behavioral problem, this isn't a child with a learning disorder that, needs some help with learning. This is a child who is just misbehaving. Why should we give them help? And there's controversy around that, because some people will say they don't deserve any help. They're misbehaving, and others will say, well, this is an actual disorder, and they do need help. By the nature of the disorder, it's not something totally under their control. It does make themselves feel very badly at times, etc., etc. And then, giving people assistance or making accommodations for people with addictive disorders is also very controversial. I'll give you an example. Let's say at work you tell your employer, hey, I have a severe alcohol use disorder. And from time to time, I'm going to drink to excess and not make it to work on Mondays. But you know what? Hey, that's the nature of my disorder. So, under Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act, I meet criteria for a disability, and I want you to give me this accommodation. The accommodation being that you'll be a little bit more lenient with my attendance. Kind of controversial, right? If you're looking at somebody with a severe alcohol use disorder as they have a psychological disorder, and then having a psychological disorder means they have some sort of disability, one would be inclined to say that, yeah, they do need special provisions. But then, when we think about, the possibility of that getting abused in terms of, many people kind of using that as a crutch to bang in work on Monday, that can be problematic. So it's interesting to look at some of the controversies in terms of classifying people with disabilities and giving them accommodations and, support. Okay, going on to slide 19. I really love this diagram here because it really puts into a visual perspective the difference between Section 504 and IDEA in terms of the severity of these disorders that we're talking about here. Okay? So, if you look at these concentric circles, I think that's the term. You'll see the outermost circle is all students, okay? So that's your whole population of school-age children, all right? Now that medium-sized circle would represent the portion of children that would meet criteria for 504. So you can see that out of the entire population of students, that is a minority of children. It's a smaller proportion of children that would meet criteria under 504. And to be honest with you, I think that middle circle is a little bit too big. It's a little misleading. It probably should be much smaller than that because many students are not going to meet criteria for 504. Remember, just because you have a diagnosed psychological disorder, now this is important, or a medical diagnosis, just because you have that doesn't mean you automatically meet criteria for 504 to say that you have a disability and that you should get services. It has to be that it has some kind of impact on your educational functioning or learning, if we're talking about the school environment, or occupational functioning, if we're talking about the work environment, because 504, Section 504 applies to both. And then the smallest circle there would be students that meet criteria under IDEA or special education law. Now it says IDEA and 504 students. The reason why it says that is because if you meet criteria for IDEA, then you definitely meet criteria for 504. You would never have a situation where a student had both Section 504 accommodations and IDEA support and accommodations. You're either going to have one or the other. Whatever's more severe, or whatever's going to give you more support, which would be IDEA. Okay, but the reason why it says IDEA and 504 students is because it wants to, give that understanding that, if you meet criteria for IDEA, you obviously by default would meet criteria for 504 because the criteria for 504 is not as stringent. Okay, however, it doesn't work the opposite way. If you meet criteria for 504, it does not mean that you're going to meet criteria for IDEA. Okay, does everyone understand that? IDEA has more stringent criteria. We're saying that the nature of the disability is having more of a substantial impact on the child's learning or educational functioning. Okay, and then down here, it talks about the differences here that under IDEA, students are qualified under one or more of 13 disabling conditions or classifications, and it's specially designed individual education programs that are planned for each student by IEP teams. And we'll talk about that in a little bit. For Section 504 students, these are students who have a substantial mental or physical impairment, and a mental impairment would be a disorder in the DSM-5, one of the many that we've been talking about, that limits one or more of the student's major life activities, okay? And a major life activity in this case would be learning, first and foremost. And that special accommodations or educate, I'm sorry, learning or educational functioning, and that special accommodations to the student's program are required as a result of that disability. Okay? A 504 accommodation plan is designed for each student according to individual need. Okay? And you can see that not only are psychological disorders and mental disorders listed here, but you could get a Section 504 plan for a physical disorder or a medical condition, such as HIV or tuberculosis or heart disease or diabetes, as long as you meet criteria for this condition having a significant impact on a major life activity, being your educational performance or functioning, and showing that you need some kind of specialized support for it. Okay? So again, just because you have diabetes doesn't mean you automatically meet criteria for Section 504. It's all about the impact. And you know, just like the DSM-5, right? I mean, this should be kind of familiar. The DSM-5, in order to meet criteria for any disorder, you know, what is our KEC phrase in all the disorders? Whether or not it's stated explicitly or it's implied, it always says the same thing, that there needs to be, you know, an impact on one's social, academic or occupational functioning. And so for Section 504 for school age children, it's saying there needs to be an impairment specifically in their educational functioning. And social functioning could be applied to that in the sense that social functioning is part of educational functioning. And so you certainly could make a case for that. That, you know, because this disorder, let's say a high functioning autistic child who has significant social delays, you know, that those social delays impede their educational functioning or their functioning at school. You certainly could make a case for that, and then they would meet criteria for either Section 504 or IDEA, depending on the severity of the impact. Okay? Okay, moving on to slide 20. Here are the 13 classifications we keep referring to for the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, or IDEA. Okay. There are two parts, a part B that is basically pertains to preschoolers, and part C that pertains to school age children from kindergarten to 12th grade, and that's what we're going to focus on here. So let's just take a gander at these 13 different classifications. We have speech and language impairment. This involves a significant delay or disorder related to communication. So, if a child had a language disorder and it was found to have a significant impact on their learning, they could meet criteria for speech and language impairment. Intellectual disability, same as the DSM-5, significant delays in both intelligence and adaptive behavior. A child with an intellectual disability would meet criteria under IDEA for IDEA's classification of intellectual disability. Orthopedic impairment is a severe impairment related to the body's bones or muscles. That's a physical impairment. Deafness is a significant hearing loss, but can be but it can be assisted with devices. Hearing impairment is a profound hearing loss. Visual impairment, including blindness, is another classification that, of course, refers to significant vision impairment. Deaf blindness is having dual impairments in both vision and hearing. None of these really apply to any of the DSM-5 disorders, but this one does. Emotional disturbance. Significant socio-emotional or unexplained difficulties. I won't get too much into that, but what they're talking about predominantly here is that the student has significant social or emotional difficulties that are resulting from some kind of psychological issue. And so if a child had a diagnosis of generalized anxiety disorder or bipolar disorder or some other kind of extreme emotional disorder that was having a very significant educational impact, they could meet criteria for emotional disturbance under IDEA. I know a lot of people look at this term and they think it sounds very harsh. It does sound very harsh. I think when IDEA is updated, they'll probably change this to emotional disability. Disturbance sounds pretty harsh, right? And then autism, same as for the DSM-5, this is a developmental social disorder that impacts primarily communication. That would certainly make you eligible for services under IDEA if it was severe enough. And then we have traumatic brain injury, which of course is a physical disorder. This is when someone has significant harm to their brain from some external factor or event, such as a car accident. Multiple disabilities means that more than one significant disability, as defined above, is present. And then specific learning disability, which is just like specific learning disorder in the DSM-5. This entails a significant difficulty acquiring academic skills or knowledge and making grade level progress in spite of sustained research validated interventions. In spite of getting a lot of remediation, that these children's skills are still below average. So that, this kind of disorder or disability would more often than not make you eligible for services under IDEA, okay? Specific learning disorder, which gets translated to specific learning disability under IDEA, okay? And a lot of these don't need a diagnosis. A lot of these can be considered by a school-based assessment so that, a psychologist that performs his or her testing and an academic specialist that performs his or her testing, a speech pathologist, doing testing, all these different professionals can do testing on children to determine whether or not they meet eligibility under IDEA. And this testing alone can determine whether or not they meet eligibility. So, in other words, that they don't necessarily need a diagnosis on the outside, from like an outside psychologist or psychiatrist. But again, it depends on the school district's policy, and it depends on the nature of the disability. Most school districts are going to want some kind of diagnosis if they're considering the classification of emotional disturbance or autism. Those should definitely be diagnosed by a professional outside of the school district, okay? Oh, and I missed one. Other health impairment. This is another classification that has to do with a medical condition impacting alertness, vitality, or strength. This is important because as a child with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, whose disorder is significantly impacting their learning or education, they could get services under IDEA by meeting criteria for other health impairment. ADHD, if it has a substantial impact on the kid's learning, would qualify under the classification of a health impairment. It's looked upon as a health impairment according to IDEA. By the way, some of you may wonder where the heck these classifications even came from. These were created by the federal government. And you may ask, well, who's the federal government to come up with their own classifications? Well, the reason why the federal government is able to come up with their own classifications is because the federal government pays for a lot of these services. So if you're paying for these services, you get to make the rules up. That's how that works, folks. Okay, going on to slide 21. What kinds of special education interventions are there? Well, there's related services in terms of a child may need speech services at school, or counseling from the psychologist or social worker, or occupational therapy or physical therapy. So that's one level of placement where a child just needs those related services, right? There's a consultant teacher placement where a teacher, a special education teacher, works with the regular education teacher or teachers, depending on the level, to help them understand the child and his or her needs. There's a resource room, which is a period during the day where a child will get extra support, help, and remediation from a special education teacher. Integrated inclusion classes, where there's a special education teacher that works alongside a regular education teacher to help the children with special needs. Special classes, which are classes taught by a special education teacher. And out of district placement, where a child is placed in a specialized school. These kind of go from the least restrictive to the most restrictive, or another way of looking at that is the lowest level of support to the highest level of support. Lowest level of support would be a child that just needs some related services. The highest level of support would be a child that needs an out-of-district placement. Okay? And as we talked about, I should say, no matter what level of placement the child needs, at any of these levels, a child can also, in addition, get specialized services such as speech and language, academic remediation, occupational or physical therapy. Orientation and mobility, which has to do with visually impaired children, teaching them how to navigate around the school environment, teacher of the deaf services, vision therapy, counseling, etc., etc., etc. Okay? The more severe the disability, the more help and services a child needs. So, severe levels of autism spectrum disorder and intellectual disability would qualify for a lot of different services. Okay. So when a child is classified under the Individuals with Disabilities Educational Act, they receive what's known as an Individualized Education Plan or IEP, and this IEP lists all of the different services that they have, their classification, is it learning disability? Is it intellectual disability? Is it autism? What is their classification? Other health impairment, etc., etc. What placement they are going to receive, the services they're going to receive, any program modifications. In other words, are they going to get specialized seating? Are they going to get access to certain kinds of technological devices? Testing accommodations, will they get extra time on their tests? Do they need directions to be read or re-explained? And SPAM and MAPS that basically refers to their level of functioning in different areas and goals. What are the specific goals that these students need to work on? Okay. All right. And then the next slide, slide 23, is going to give you a link to look at what an actual IEP looks like if you're interested. So that is a sample IEP for anyone who is interested. Okay, so you don't need to know all about the different sections of an IEP and all of that. I just wanted to present you with an example of what one looks like so you get a feel for it, okay? Or an understanding. And again, remember, if a student has an IEP, then they are receiving special education support. If a child is receiving special education support, they have met eligibility requirements for classification under what? IDEA. Okay. So IDEA synonymous with special education law. Section 504 and IDEA are two different sets of laws, two different sets of federal laws that entitle people to extra support in one way or the other if they meet criteria. Okay. And by the way, you might be wondering, well, if children get an IEP, for special education, what do they get if they have a 504? They get what's called a Section 504 plan. And it looks a little similar, but the difference being that it's usually not nearly as lengthy because these children, by their very nature, do not need as much support as children in special education. So these documents talk more about, maybe different kinds of program modifications, like, being allowed to take the test in a separate location and extra time, given extra time on tests, and maybe having some support services like counseling, but nothing nearly as extensive as children with an IEP who are classified under special education law. Okay? Okay. Moving right along. The last neurodevelopmental disorder I wanted to talk about is Tourette's disorder. And I separated Tourette's disorder from the other ones because although you may meet criteria under special education law or IDEA if your Tourette's disorder is so severe, or criteria for a Section 504 plan. Many students with Tourette's disorder do not need any kind of specialized support at school. So that there are many times where the disorder does not have such a negative impact on the educational functioning, like the other disorders, which, tend to have a much higher probability that's going to have a negative impact on their functioning at school. This is not to say that no child with Tourette's will need extra support at school. Certainly, there are children with very severe Tourette's disorder that absolutely will need some extra support because it could be found to have a direct substantial impact on their educational functioning. In terms of interfering with their attention, but just that there are plenty of children that have it that don't need extra support. Okay, so I kind of added this one at the end as a separate discussion. Okay, and we talked about Tourette's disorder really involving tics, right? Motor tics, which are involuntary motor movements, and vocal tics, involuntary vocalizations. And they could be very subtle, just like a little like, right? Or very pronounced, okay, where they're actually saying full words. And same thing with the motor tics, it could be a little shoulder movement every now and then, or it could be a full head jerk. Kind of movement. Okay. There, in terms of causes, there is a strong genetic influence and an imbalance. Oh, I'm sorry. There's a strong genetic influence for this disorder. But in addition to that, there's also an imbalance in neurotransmitters that has often been found, particularly with dopamine, that is also related to this disorder. Furthermore, prenatal exposure to toxins such as maternal smoking, labor complications, and birth weight are associated with the severity level of tics. Okay, so that when these factors are involved, that the tics tend to be more severe in these individuals. Aroused states such as being very anxious or excited, stressors, both positive and negative, fatigue, and non-focused activity in terms of, like, for example, laying on the couch just watching TV versus doing schoolwork can exacerbate or worsen tics. Also, certain gestures or sounds may trigger tics and result in copying behavior, which is unintentional. So that if they hear, sometimes if they're, speaking with somebody and somebody makes a certain gesture or sound, they will mimic it. But they're not doing this to make fun of the person, or they're not doing it intentionally. It's just kind of like this reflexive, automatic action that they do, some of them, not all of them. Okay. Tourette's has a very high comorbidity rate with ADHD and OCD related conditions. And again, talking about comorbidity, comorbidity refers to the high incidence rate that is, shared amongst disorders. In other words, if you have Tourette's, there is also going to be high probability that you will also have ADHD or an OCD related condition. And it makes sense because these conditions have a lot of similarities in terms of, neurology. And so that makes sense that if you're susceptible to having one of these, you'll be susceptible to having more than one of these. Again, not to say all people with Tourette's have ADHD or OCD, but a lot of them do. Medical treatment for Tourette's disorder. There are antipsychotics such as haloperidol, or the brand name known as Haldol, risperidone, the brand name being Risperdal. Anti-seizure medication can help, such as topiramate, brand name Topiramex. Blood pressure medication, clonidine or Catapress. Botulinum or Botox can be injected into the site of the tic, if it's a motor tic, to help lessen the degree of the tic. Stimulants such as methylphenidate or Ritalin or dextroamphetamine or Adderall for related concentration difficulties. A lot of these people have concentration difficulties because when you're constantly having tics, it distracts you and makes you lose concentration or focus. Sometimes, though, these stimulant medications can actually worsen the tics in some people. So, in some people, they're contraindicated or should not be prescribed. And a lot of times, the only way you find that out is trial and error. And then antidepressants such as fluoxetine or Prozac for associated symptoms of anxiety, depression, obsessions, and compulsions. A lot of people with tics have anxiety because they're so worried about their tics bringing undue attention to them and, embarrassing them. And certainly that could elicit social rejection and cause depression and all sorts of other negative consequences. Okay? Slide 26, psychological interventions for Tourette's disorder. Cognitive behavioral therapy can be very helpful in terms of teaching people with Tourette's disorder cognitive coping skills, learning how to cope with the adverse impact of their disorder. It can teach them self-monitoring skills, just like for people with ADHD, so that if they're more aware of their tics, they may be able to control them a little bit more, or at least control them to some degree. You're never going to have complete control over your tics. they're, resulting from a neurological condition. But the more aware you are of them, the more influence you can have over them. Also, to teach these people relaxation training for when they experience anxiety and stress, and a specific cognitive behavioral therapy technique for Tourette's disorder is habit reversal, where we have them engage in an incompatible behavior with the tic, okay? So that if you're doing this kind of shoulder bob every now and then, what we might teach you is to possibly hold down that shoulder so that it can't move, right? Or, if you have some other kind of motor tic, like rolling your eyes to the right, we may have the person practice rolling their eyes to the left so that, it's, kind of like fighting against the tic, so to speak. Okay? And psychodynamic and family systems are not so helpful for the direct alleviation of Tourette's disorder, but could be helpful for associated symptoms and disorders, just as we've seen for the other neurodevelopmental disorders. Okay? All right. Lastly, some words about comorbidity rates for neurodevelopmental disorders. There is a lot of poor practice that exists in the fields and professions related to diagnosis. We're talking about, psychiatrists, psychologists, etc. Many professionals, quote, overdiagnose in that they code multiple disorders when in actuality only one is present, so that they are diagnosing more than one disorder for an individual when they shouldn't be. For example, diagnosing children with ADHD and LD, or learning disorder, is fairly common. Many children with ADHD have academic struggles and skill weaknesses, but because of their ADHD-related symptoms, which are inattention, off-task behavior, etc. Conversely, children with learning disorder often have attentional problems, but of course they would, because when you are struggling to learn material, you will have difficulty focusing after a while. I always use the example. If you put me in a German class, after about 20 minutes or so, I am going to look like an ADHD person. I'm going to be off task. I'm going to be distracted, focusing on all these different external stimuli. My mind is going to wander. And why? Because I'm not understanding what's going on and I'm having difficulty learning because I have no background in German. So it's an extreme example, but, kind of makes the case. Okay, similarly, diagnosing children with autism spectrum disorder and ADHD is also fairly common. Although inattention and hyperactivity are not symptoms included in the diagnostic criteria for autism spectrum disorder, many children with ASD are distractible and off task because of the nature of this disorder. If you have social communication deficits, or low intellectual ability, which is true for 30% of these children, or perseverating on other interests, you are going to be inattentive to the class lesson and thus off task and look ADHD, when in actuality you don't have ADHD, you have autism spectrum disorder, which causes you to look ADHD. So it's just a caveat that I throw out there that, be aware that this trend exists, and I don't know what really motivates this. Maybe it's like, these licensed professionals don't want to feel like they missed anything, but it's very unnecessary, and it really makes the person look more disabled than they are. When we say that, oh, this person has five different disorders, when meanwhile they have one, and that's their primary disorder. Or it takes the focus off of, the primary disorder that we should be focusing on, right? Or that we should be, putting all our efforts into. So just a caveat, that this kind of practice exists, and it's a pet peeve of mine. Okay, so you now have completed all of the lectures for exam number two, okay, which is going to occur on April 6th, which is a week from this Monday. So this is the last lecture until then. So any of you who are not caught up with your lectures, get cracking, which anyone listening to this is probably caught up with their lectures, right? But pass on the word. That's my point. Right. Okay. So next week, I will give you guys more information about the logistics of the exam, and any other kind of information I need to disseminate to you. And then after that exam, we will proceed with the final third part of the course. Okay, stay healthy, stay safe. Hi, class. This is your professor, Dr. Fields. We are in the final third of the course. So this lecture and the subsequent lectures are all going to be on exam number three. Before I start with this next new lecture, I just wanted to give you guys some tips in terms of making the most out of these lectures and really actively listening and studying. One thing that I quickly came to discover when I was an undergrad is if you're just listening to the lecture and reading the slides or reading from the book, you're really not actively listening. Now, one of the problems that I think that a lot of you are experiencing is because you have the slides, you don't really feel like you need to take notes. When you're not writing down information, you're not retaining information as well. That is a research-proven fact. So one of the things I might recommend is you actually taking some notes while you're listening to the lecture and looking at the slides, like you would in class. The other thing is when we're talking about these different disorders and conditions, in order to like actively listen and really comprehend the information, don't just listen to me rambling and read off the slides. Really try to process the information and understand the implications. Like, what does this mean? What is this like for a person to have this kind of disorder? What kind of experience would that be? Visualize some of these conditions and the impact that they have on people. And try to make, build, try to build